This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, welcome to the show. Today we have a brilliant guest, Nick Helm. He's a brilliant comedian. You may know him also from the TV shows Uncle, Loaded. He had his own show, Heavy Entertainment, and he's currently in the TV show on Dave called Eat Your Heart Out, which is a show I would love to do myself, where he just gets to eat lots of food and hang out with friends and comedians. I mean, what wouldn't you like about that? So here's his first choice of his two songs. This is by an act I've never really heard of called Gowan. We'll find out when I ask him why he picked this.
You got ways to take hold of my thoughts.
Moonlight Desires by Gowans. I've never heard of Gowan. That was the first song from our guest today, Nick Helm. Why did you pick that?
I think that is, it's just one of the most amazing, magical songs that I'd ever heard. And it comes from a film called Wolf Cop, which is a film about, it's a Canadian film that is about a...
You've gone misty-eyed just talking about it.
Well, the film is all right. The film's all right. It's kind of like, it's like 75% great, and then there's this weird kind of like witchcraft cult subplot that's been put into it.
Is that the wolf part of it?
Which isn't great. No, but the transformation scenes are amazing, and that song, I mean, it's the most romantic, beautiful song you've ever heard, and it sort of somehow seamlessly blends in with the actual score that is written by another, I think they're called Blazing Guns, and it's by another band. And then they bring in this song, and the great thing about it is it's the big romantic moment where a man who's transformed into a giant wolf has sex with a woman with gigantic fake breasts, and then they play this song in a prison cell, and then the song comes over it, and it's just, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Is this an 80s movie?
No, it's sort of an 80s throwback, but it was made a couple of years ago.
2014.
There's a sequel coming out.
And is that a song? Is Gowan from the 80s, though?
Gowan's from the
80s. That song's from the 80s.
I think they did sort of like a John Landis thing where it's got Moonlight in it and it's about a werewolf. So they put the song in. And I think they probably did a Google search.
The soundtrack to American Werewolf, by the way, is just phenomenal,
amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
That song just reminded me so much of so many 80s films where you'd have the montage two thirds of the way in and something like. I just kept thinking of Mannequin.
Oh, right.
You know, that nothing's going to.
It's a sex montage.
Yeah,
it's really funny because he's got like a wolf cock, and it's amazing.
I've got to check this out, wolf cock. That's amazing.
There's a shot when he's going for a wee.
Yeah,
that, like, as a human, the first time he changes into a wolf, and his penis splits in half, and a hairy wolf cock comes out of it.
They play
that song though.
Oh my god.
And that's the most beautiful song I've ever heard.
Have you ever suffered anything quite as gruesome as that when you've been to the toilet?
I have, and it's in my tour. It's actually the middle section of my tour show.
But it wasn't a wolf. What animal was penis cock. Came through your penis?
No animal came through my penis.
We were just talking about tapes. Cassettes.
As
we were listening to that song, because we were talking a bit about Dire Straits, bizarrely, and you just made me remember a kind of bygone, like, cassette singles. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
That you'd have to, all that effort, just for one song.
One song, yeah. I've got what did I get? I got Alice Cooper, Lost in America on tape. It's one of my most prized possessions.
And you still have it?
Yeah, it's a single. I can't play it anymore.
No, that's the problem, is where, and they always fucked up. They always chewed up, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you had to, like, wind it around with a biro.
I was in America, like, I don't know, 2 months ago, and I went into a secondhand record shop, and I found a cassette single of Philip Schofield singing the song from Joseph and His Technicolor Dreamcoat.
In America. That's a great story, because it's also, you've dropped in the fact that you've just been to America.
Yeah, I've been to America.
That's weird though, isn't it?
Like, who owned that in the first place out there?
Yeah.
Unless someone travelled to America, got rid of it. They wanted to get rid of that cassette so badly they went to America to do it. And who's going to buy it?
Of a cassette tape. Is it a single?
It was a single.
Oh, that's so weird.
It was like
Philip Schofield single.
What were the songs?
Whereabouts in America?
It was Los Angeles, yeah.
Of course.
So, you know, you made me drop that in by asking the question.
Yeah, but you were desperate to do it. I was in Pennsylvania, and I was in...
Name dropper.
We were in the middle of nowhere, and it was this... And we went into this kind of, like, second-hand shop. And... a thrift store, that's what they call them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had an original Nakatomi Plaza Die Hard arcade machine.
Wow.
And I could afford it, but I couldn't get it home. And I was so gutted.
It would cost like tens of thousands to ship something like that,
wouldn't
it?
Yeah, well, yeah. It was like a few hundred.
So what was it? Like, is it, was it in the shape
machine? I think it
of
had,
the building or something?
No, it was the thing, and I think it had sort of like machine gun kind of controllers.
Yeah.
And then the idea is that you go through Nakatomi Plaza. And
then do you hear occasional, like, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, and stuff like that? Or?
I'd hope so. It wasn't plugged in, but it was a really old one. I think that there might have been kind of a game that was made a few years ago, but this one looked really old.
Do you remember the Daley Thompson arcade machines where you had to hit those two buttons really fast? fast to make them run.
Imagine finding that in America. Yeah. That would be weird.
Or Daley Thompson.
Daley Thompson.
They're massive. They love him out there. When we were listening to that music, because you do a lot of music in your live shows, but actually a lot of the TV stuff you've been doing lately does not involve as much music as... So you've probably got a whole audience who know you more for like parts you've played in shows or for the recent Dave show. It's still a big part of your live stuff, right?
I don't know. I mean, Uncle always had music. There was Uncle, and that was at the beginning of the year, and then I've done a couple of things without music. But basically, I've sort of slowed down a bit.
Just before you came in, you said you were boxing, so...
I've slowed down a bit in terms of... Well, I haven't slowed down, it's just that you have less time to devote to... So when I started out, I used to play guitar a lot and write a lot of songs, and then when shows came out, you'd go, oh, and I'd do an Edinburgh show every year. I haven't done an Edinburgh show in, like, a new one since 2013, where I got Foster's nominated. That was the last one I did.
Foster's? We don't know what that means anymore.
It's what the old-timers call the Perrier. Nominated.
It went from water to booze to something else now. I don't know what it is.
I love Foster's. And, well, I would have loved it slightly more.
Yeah,
had it been more than
it's a
nom.
Bittersweet thing now, isn't
a double
it?
Nom.
It gets you pissed and angry.
I've just been working on other stuff since 2013, and what's good about Edinburgh is that it always gives you like an annual deadline to get like a body of work done. So after every Edinburgh, there'd be like four songs that would end up in the show, but I'd have written about eight.
Yeah.
Now with this show, I've kind of been writing for like a couple of years, and I've got maybe an album's worth of songs that are just. That could, like a concept album that could be around this show, but I've got four songs in this show.
Do you find doing the more stand-up stuff or the song, what do you find comes easier for you?
The stand-up is easier, and it would be, it would be a lot. I mean, these songs aren't particularly funny either.
They're serious.
I like writing music, and one of the things about writing, you know, comedy songs is that there has to be sort of like some sort of extra purpose other than musical.
Yeah.
And that's quite frustrating sometimes. But this song, this show, I haven't really focused on.
Do you ever write, because I've done comedy songs in my stuff as well, and sometimes I have a great song, but it's just not funny enough.
Yeah, I've cut loads of those.
Yeah. Isn't it annoying because you're like, God, I really love that melody that chorus.
You just sort of doubt that the audience are going to kind of stick with you for something like that. And it's also a little bit navel-gazy and a bit self-indulgent.
Yeah.
So there has to be a purpose. So, but these songs, they're sort of funny in an ironic way, but that's sort of deliberate, and I haven't really concentrated on writing punchlines and stuff. They're just sort of like, they're meant to project a general vibe. I'm slightly nervous about it because this is my first tour, and I don't know what
people. You haven't toured before?
I've done miniature work in progress tours, but that was like a couple of years ago. And this is sort of, and all of that work has been kind of like towards putting a tour.
So in
together.
The past, you've just done Edinburgh and then maybe a London
Soho,
resident. Yeah.
Yeah. Then I did a couple of my shows I took to Wales and stuff. But basically, one of my shows had a band in. One of my shows had kind of like this massive set, like a huge set. One of my shows had loads of costume changes and everything like that. And they were always kind of like really, and they needed a technician and all of this complicated parts. So they were always too complicated.
Yeah, did you ever make any money?
Never made any money. Because of Edinburgh. I just did it for love.
Well, and no one ever makes money from Edinburgh, do they? Unless you're like Jason Byrne or someone.
I think there's a way of using Edinburgh to springboard extra stuff out of it.
Yeah.
And my stuff just began and ended in Edinburgh, really.
Really? See, I did a tour once where I had some songs from previous years. I thought, I just want to be in a band. So I took a band on the road and lost so much money doing it.
Well, yeah,
because they were all proper professional musicians.
And they have like, daily rates.
Do it for like, you know, profit share. No, thank you.
Do it for love. Yeah. Do it for a split. It's just like, no.
Travel card? No, fuck you.
Well, I did the Kentish Town Forum and I made no money off of that.
Really?
Yeah, because of the band. And it's just like, I love working with
bands. But that's like, isn't that like the 2,000 seats or something?
Yeah.
How much were your band charging?
Was it 1,000 seats?
Oh, 1,000.
Was it 1,000? 1,500, let's say.
Jesus, you need to get less expensive. You shouldn't employ Dave Gilmore.
They are an amazing band, but then at the same time, but that's what people always ask. They say, oh, are you going to bring the band? And you go, if you fucking pay for it.
Yeah. And it's fun, though, isn't it? That's the thing.
Well, I'm touring with my mate David Trent, and yeah, that's the thing about stand-up, isn't it? It's lonely, and it can be really boring, the 23 hours that you're not on stage. So I'm taking my mate with me, and we're kind of like doing that.
Well, good luck with the tour. The one thing that I really want to wish you luck with, this is my clever segue into talking about your current TV show, but you are about, because I just would have assumed you've been on tour before, but you are about to embark on the diet of a tour, which in some parts of this country is something I wouldn't wish upon anyone.
Yeah.
You come off stage, a great show, you're buzzing, let's go and get some food. Nothing.
Nothing is, everything's gone. Well, we had an experience like that. We did a 10-day work in progress tour of the Midlands.
Right. Specifically the Midlands.
In 2015. I don't know why we did the Midlands either. It might have been that there's, we had a promoter.
Quite heavy metal about that, isn't there?
It was weird. I'm really nervous about that. Well, I've had to rewrite an entire show.
Because
I did the Midlands 2 years ago, and they constitute as like a third of my tour dates.
Yeah.
And it was a really good show, but I never toured it. But I think enough people have seen it on my tour dates that I have to write another show.
So just for the Midlands.
Just for the Midlands. Yeah. Just for Leeds, specifically Leeds in the Wardrobe. That's annoying, but I do love the Wardrobe in Leeds. But yeah, so we were there, and I get really nervous before I go on stage, so I can't eat in the day. And so when you come on stage, you're starving.
And if you're in, like, I don't know, you've got tour dates here, but when you're in somewhere like Winchester or there's a venue called The Wardrobe.
The Wardrobe.
I've never heard of that. I kept thinking, why is he in a wardrobe? What's going on here?
It's a music venue.
No wonder that was a tough gig.
In Hull, when we went to Fruit.
Yeah.
That was difficult. I just don't think we ate.
So you've just made a show where you go and eat at amazing places.
Mm.
And now you're going to do how many dates?
I think it's 28.
28 dates. And you know, one of my beef about the state of the restaurant world at the moment, which is that there's too many chains.
Right.
There's like, everything's just being franchised. And wherever you go, you just see this cluster of Pizza Express, Byron, Wagamama's. And it's like, it's taken all the sort of personality out of...
Well, even something that I really, really love, like Bone Daddy's in Soho, that's got like three or four chains across London. And I don't begrudge it. I think that's brilliant. Bone Daddy's is... amazing. I love it.
Polpo, that's a great one. That has chains and stuff. But when you go on tour, you actually pray to God that you see a Wagamama's, because that's how bad it gets. You're like, oh God, there's that little cluster.
I don't think
you'd
ever get that bad.
You will. I guarantee it.
Do you know what about Wagamama's is that I've never ordered right. I ordered right once, and then every subsequent visit has been like searching for that white whale or something that you panic
they
the first time.
They do white whale? Oh my God, that's on the speciality menu.
But you panic the first time and you order something at random and it's amazing, and then you go back every time and you can never find it again. And
well, the worst one is when you're in a relationship and you like a restaurant but that person's had a bad experience and you can never go back there with them.
Or when you're in a relationship and you take someone to your favourite restaurant or like a pub for a Sunday lunch, and then they act so atrociously towards the staff.
Oh my God.
And they hate the food so much that you can never go back there.
This feels very raw, what you're saying to me. Is this something that's happened quite recently?
It wasn't recently.
No.
I should let it go. I have gone back to that place now. But I mean, there was like...
Oh, that is... Yeah.
But it did mean switching partners.
So how did the TV show come about? This is Eat Your Heart Out on Dave.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm very jealous that you got to do this show. It seems like just a dream, really.
It was an absolute fucking nightmare.
Was it?
It was.
Oh, come on, don't say that.
I love it. I love the show. It's come out really nice, but it was really difficult to make.
Because?
We didn't have any budget and we didn't have any time. And
so you had to pay for all the meals yourself?
No, it wouldn't get as bad as that, but yeah.
Well, definitely tipped
yourself. Schedule was ridiculous. We had 16 episodes and we had 4 days to write it.
What? Four days to write 16 episodes?
Yeah.
Surely that is it's actually impossible. Yeah,
yeah.
So unless you just wrote he eats for 20 minutes.
That's it, really.
In fact, it started off as a show not about food, and you're like, "What if we just have me eating?"
Well, that was the, I think that was the thing, really. And then we had the budget to film an episode a day.
Yeah.
So you're eating fried chicken and cocktails at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then you're full, and then you're eating another meal at 11, and you're full, and then you're eating another meal at 3, and then you're full, and then you're eating another meal at 6. God. And it's actually.
This does actually.
If
sound
you actually watch
horrific.
It, I hardly eat anything. There's like one where I'm trying to stuff half a pancake in my face in Brighton, and that's the only shot of anything that you see me eat. I mean, I'm not complaining, I love making it. The crew are great and everything, but it's just sort of. I don't eat a lot.
Yeah.
I drink a lot, so I.
Okay.
So
maybe you should have done a drinking show.
I tried to put as much drinking in it as possible, and we've just kind of taken it out in the edit. Compliance wouldn't allow it.
But
if you look in the early episodes, I'm always holding a drink. And so we were filming, and the crew were all really great. And what happens is when you eat a bit of it, and then, you know, because the crew were on their feet all day, you give the rest of the crew.
Yeah.
And I'd have like a bite out of the food, and we had this really tall sound man called Sean Smith. If you're listening, hello, Sean.
Sean.
And he was really tall and skinny, and he would just literally just eat everything. He was like a one-man swarm.
What,
he'd
come in afterwards?
Yeah. He would be waiting off camera with a fork in his hand, and he'd just come in and eat everything.
Well, that's kind of handy to have. Though,
it was
right?
great, because there was no waste on the series.
Yeah, yeah. That's good.
So
I always feel sorry for... Was he the boom operator?
He was the boom operator.
Yeah. I feel sorry for boom operators.
Don't.
They're the only people that... The only time anyone speaks to them is when they do something wrong. No one finishes a take and goes, well boomed, really,
oh, really?
Well boomed. No,
oh,
it's only boom.
Oh, well, he must have felt very special, because I think he's in several episodes.
Is he?
We make a feature of him. Yeah.
Oh, well, there you
I
go.
Love him.
There you go, and he got well fed. He must. I bet he's praying for a second series, isn't he?
I loved all the crew. Yeah, well, he must be starving right now.
Did you think it would be fun to do a food show, but realise that gluttony is not a pleasurable experience?
I don't really like people watching me eat. I like eating alone, in the dark, full of shame.
The impression I'm getting is that you might have been the wrong man for this job.
It was a weird one. So, yeah. So, when the idea came along to make a food show about 2 years ago, and I was approached, and they said, do you want to make a food show? And it was just at the time that I was going through a breakup.
Mm.
And
which you feature in the show.
But that's a fictional breakup. But this was like a breakup where you go, right, okay, well, I'm going to take every job that I can get out of the house.
Yeah.
And this was a non-broadcast pilot. And they said, do you want to do this thing? And I was like, yes, I'll do that. I said yes to everything at that time. And so we went and made it. And I think it was originally with Channel 4, and Channel 4 had passed on it. And I thought it was all right, but it was a very straight food show. It was almost like a Top Gear for food thing,
mm-hmm.
where I was being a presenter and I was talking down the lens, and I didn't really like it. And then they said, Dave would like to make 20 episodes. Mm. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to do that. And they said, well, we're 16. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to make 16 episodes of that. But what if we smuggled in a comedy series?
Yeah.
I had a comedy series called Heavy Entertainment, which didn't get recommissioned. And I was just like, and I've been desperate to make another thing.
Yeah.
And so they were just like, well, you've got this food show and you can kind of do what you want with it.
So you brought in, like, you know, you mentioned David Trent. He's in the show.
My mum and dad are in the show. Yeah, so basically...
And there's like a bit of a narrative thing as well, isn't there? So these are all things that you put in to keep it like interesting to you. And
I love cooking. And so I love cooking, and I do like restaurants. I like going to restaurants and stuff. I don't like overeating, and I'll eat like maybe once a day properly. And so like the concept of doing like a food show where you're just eating a lot, it's kind of, and as I say, I don't like really people looking at me when I'm eating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people are like that. So the idea of doing like a food show where the main focus is people watching you stuff your face, you know, I felt like really worried about that, you know. I had a lot of trepidation about that.
I'd happily have someone just watch me eat.
The food was amazing, is the thing.
Even like seeing stuff go down my chin.
I hate all that. I think that, you know, you don't want to give people any more ammunition than they really need. So yeah, so the whole thing basically came from the fact that they wanted a food show and I wanted to do a comedy show.
Yeah.
So, but because food is very personal to me, so kind of like what I brought to it was the, you know, the personal journey type thing. So it starts off where in North London, where we are now, yeah, where I live, and then and it's where I grew up, and then it goes to St Albans, where my family live, and then it goes to kind of Brighton, where I used to live. And so every place on the map is either populated with places that I grew up, that I associate with food, that I have food memories from,
yeah.
Or it's with people that, you know, some of my, you know, my best friend, John Harrison, who's a journalist over at the BBC, he's in it. And then my other best friend, Jen from Brighton, she's in it. And these are all like people that are my friends.
I love that you're pointing to where
they
are.
I'm pointing where they are. And like, so all the guests are off my phone. And,
yeah.
And so
you also had a meal with heroes.
Yeah.
People that, like, I suppose more comedic icons and people. Were there anyone that you were really worried or nervous about meeting and eating, especially now that we know that you're actually a bit self-conscious about people watching you eat? That's quite a lot of pressure, isn't it? Hey, I'm a big fan of your work. Now I've got to eat in front of you.
I think I was pretty much nervous about every single person that was in it because it was an untested,
yeah,
format. When we started as well, we were sort of like making up as we went along, and that was very nerve-wracking, especially when you got someone like Bob Mortimer in it, and you think not just you don't want to let him down, but just by him being associated with it will bring in a wider audience than I would by myself.
Was that moment where Paul Whitehouse turned up, was that genuinely a coincidence?
That was, I tell you what, that was genuinely a coincidence.
Oh, wow.
Up until the point where it emerged that Bob Mortimer had texted him. But he does live around the corner. But we only found that out long after, when he actually bangs on the window, yeah. I'm just there going, oh my God, yeah, this is a double whammy. What, yeah, are the, yeah, chances that Paul Whitehouse walked past? But the legend is better, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a complete coincidence. We didn't
but
know.
But it was a coincidence for you.
We didn't know.
Yeah.
None of the crew knew either.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what happens. You get Bob Mortimer in, yeah, and he kind of brings in Paul Whitehouse. It was amazing.
I love that. So tell us like what the tour is about, because you've got a brilliant title, which is one of those ones that I kind of wish I'd come up with. There is nothing you can do to me that I haven't already done to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Is that aimed at a particular person, or is that...
No, that's aimed at the audience.
Is it?
I think, yeah. It's kind of like the show was originally going to be... I think it's a really good title, but the show was originally going to be quite political. And I, because, you know, when you're coming up with ideas for shows, this is in January, and you're thinking, oh God, there's so many hot topics.
Yeah.
And then I just got bored. And I was like, you hear it all the time.
Yeah.
And so I just, so what I've written actually is like a really personal show. It doesn't sound like a laugh riot. It's a really personal show about depression. And, okay, yeah, the show basically systematically goes through almost all the things that you shouldn't talk about in a comedy show. And it's sort of quite challenging for some audiences.
Can you give any examples of... Is this something, if you don't mind me asking, that you've obviously suffered with depression? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I always remember that my favourite Care Bear used to be the one with the thundercloud on his stomach. And you go, that's not a happy, yeah, kid, is it? So I've always had depression, but I've always written about it, and I've always kind of like tried to deal with it, but not in sort of like a navel-gazing kind of way, but just sort of trying to just be really honest and open with.
Do you find it like a bit, it's exercising, it's like...
I think it's cathartic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is a bit cathartic, but I also think that it's cathartic for audience members as well. I don't see the point in kind of being one of those wearing a smile comedians and you just come out and you say, isn't everything wonderful? And you try and trick people into thinking that isn't the world perfect and lovely, and then they leave smiling and it gives them like half an hour. I think that it's much more important to me to kind of deal with actual issues, but I don't come out and talk about, oh, I have depression and this is how I felt with it. I try and do it kind of in an abstract way, where it's, yeah, like a collage where you've got songs and routines and jokes, and you have bits and pieces that don't necessarily directly relate to each other, but then when you look at the whole show, and think about it, you kind of go, oh, we address sort of like an issue. Like,
I think I'm sort of not interested in seeing other comedians who don't talk about something that is quite real or personal or a bit.
Oh, I thought it was a roller coaster, that sentence. I thought I'm sort of not interested in.
There's a lot of double negatives going in. I'm sort of not interested in seeing what you've just described to me, Nick. Yeah. I've got to be honest.
Yeah.
You're like, what? Ooh, where's he going?
Yeah.
No, just like, you know, like you say, the sort of just telling a couple of jokes and, you know, that there's always been a description of some comics, they're like, you know, like being with your mate down the pub sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay in like small bite sizes or whatever, but if you want to go and see, if you're investing in a persona and going to see someone's full show, you kind of want some like meat to it, don't you?
I think so. And I think that it's sort of, I've always been slightly, not necessarily tried to, but I've always been slightly challenging for audiences where, you know, 50% of them love it and 50% of them hate it. And
how do you cope with that?
I thought I was mainstream. I'm absolutely gutted. When I found out that I was challenging, I was like, ah. But all of my shows have sort of... I did a show called One Man Megamyth, and that was about the trappings of fame. And I did a show called This Means War, and it was sort of about war, but really it was about relationships. And then I did a show called Dare to Dream, and that was about, you know, ambition and hope and when you're young, looking into the future, and then the reality of growing up. And then... underneath, as a subtext, all of that is about this, my stage persona is a really sort of broken, depressed individual who's basically just completely lost on stage. And I think this show is the first time that that's kind of like not been the subtext, but is actually been like the main body of the show.
And so from the stuff that people know you mostly from on TV and stuff they come to see, do you notice that some people are like, oh, this isn't the guy that I...
It's weird. Uncle fans are the weirdest because they come and they're confused because it's not Uncle. And it's just like, well, Uncle's a half-hour sitcom for a start.
Yeah.
And I'm an act. But I'm also a musical comedian that talks about depression, and Uncle starts with a suicide.
Yeah, an attempted suicide.
And has songs all the way through it. And you go, it's not...
Yeah, it's not a million miles apart.
In a Venn diagram, there is a lot of crossover.
Definitely.
But I think what they like most about Uncle is the 12-year-old kid. And I can't be him.
And they were like, him. Oh, we were coming to see the kid.
Oh, we wanted to see a chat about
Nick
puberty.
Helm is the adult, right?
Right, right. So I find that weird.
Yeah, that's...
But I'm also sort of interested to see what the food show's done.
Because
if I get an audience from the food show as well, that's pre-Watershed. And that is kind of like the nicest I've ever been on TV. And
do you ever have voices in your head that go, oh, maybe I need to cater to them a bit?
There was a huge rift in me that was kind of like, right, well, I'll try and please everyone. I'll try and do stuff for Uncle fans. I'll try and do stuff for Loaded fans. And I'll try and do stuff for, you know, people that have seen me on 8 After. And then you just think, right, well, I've just got to do my show. And I've got to do, you know, I've got to write what I feel like this year.
Yeah, 100%.
A show is always like, it's a snapshot of where you were at that moment in time. This is a good snapshot of where I have been in for the first 6 months of the year.
I was always very, I think you're absolutely right that you have to just do that. And like some percentage of the audience may not come along for the ride.
They might not come back. And that's a risk that you've got to take.
I was always so impressed with Simon Amstel when he just basically... decided to, you know, he felt like he had a thing that he had to say, and he started doing stand-up that was so the polar opposite of what he was known for from Buzzcocks and things. And I saw some of his shows and gigs, and people in the early years when he sort of changed his tone and style just weren't, they were like, we want the guy that slags off Preston or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he stuck to his guns, and over a period of time people now know what to expect, and he gets just as big audiences, but they're like, they've slightly changed or evolved or whatever.
I think that's it, really. I think also, you know, every time I do anything, I try and do sort of the opposite of what I've just done. So when I did Uncle, I followed that up with Heavy Entertainment, and I followed that up with Loaded, and the character in Loaded is different from the character in Uncle. Uncle is different from my live show and my stage persona, which is different from who I am as a person, and then the food show is different again. And you just try and do something that's different so that people don't literally pigeonhole you and think, oh, he's the guy that does that. Every time, even down to every time I did, when I used to do 8 out of 10 cats, every time I did that, I used to have different facial hair because I didn't want to be, that's the guy with the beard.
Yeah.
And even now when I don't have a beard, people go, oh, you've shaved. And it's just like, I'm not a character on a TV show. I'm an actual human being.
You're the opposite of branding.
Yeah, I'm like literally try and change. Yeah. I'm like a really low rent Madonna who's always changing her image.
Do you do costume changes? You do, don't you?
I used
you?
To do costume changes, but that's such a bore, like, and they're so expensive to get costumes made.
Will you be releasing a sex book?
Hopefully,
at some point,
fingers crossed.
Good.
That's what it's going to be called. That's what it's going to be called. That's
Nick Helms' sex book.
Fingers crossed.
I think,
it's a new technique I've come up with.
I like that. You see, that was too fast for me. I didn't even... you mentioned Loaded. That looked like it was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Did you just sort of pretend it was real for however long you were filming for? This was the show where you and your best mates all, like, invented an app and...
Became millionaires.
Millionaires,
I mean, I love Uncle, and that's... Like that whole crew and all the other actors, they're like a family.
Yeah.
We worked with each other for 4 years, and I've seen that kid grow up, and it's brilliant. But we were never allowed to swear on set, and you know, it was just like, it was kind of like, it was always like walking on eggshells a bit. And
because of the kid, or there was
because
some...
of the kid and BBC, and it was all like a lot of compliance stuff. And I don't begrudge any of it, and I loved working with him. And you know, I'm a responsible adult anyway, and it's not like I was giving him drugs or anything, but you know, it's kind of like it was such a different nice experience to turn up for work every day, and us four guys, we were all in our 30s and we all had like similar interests. We're all sort of like Star Wars nerds. And
you were swearing left, right, and center.
We were swearing all the time. We were swearing all the time. And
you just used to turn up going, fuck, 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 just because you could.
I mean, well, there was a blooper reel that was just all of the times that I said cunt. And it was just me over and over again just swearing. And I didn't realise how much I swore when I wasn't. I didn't swear once for the whole 6 weeks filming process with Uncle.
Yeah.
And our relationship, me and the kids' relationship, was really lovely. He'd come in and say, oh, I've just found a new band that my dad's got a record, and I've just found a new band. And I was like, oh, who are they? And he'd say, Pulp. And I'd be like, oh, fucking hell, I am so old. With this, it's like we already knew who Pulp were. And there'd be a time when Jim and Sam were filming a scene upstairs in the... We had this big concrete bunker, which was the mansion that we were staying in. It was a £5 million mansion in the middle of a royal park. It used to be a submarine testing unit. So there were these huge, cavernous kind of concrete sort of garage spaces, but they were huge. They were kind of... It was like a bunker. With like these big concrete pillars in it. And so Jim and Sam were filming upstairs. And so me and Johnny, because we weren't needed, we just got these automatic Nerf guns. And we went in and we were just like, I think it was
that
the
does
most.
Sound like a lot.
It was the most fun I've ever had as an adult and possibly a child. We were like shooting at each other and then reloading and hiding behind pillars. And they were like filming and it was a quiet set upstairs and we were just going for it downstairs.
Are they doing more? Because it sounds like this is really good for you.
It was very, I mean, you talk about Catholicism.
That was my next thing.
I think the chances of another series at this stage are a bit slim, but we're still waiting to find out from AMC to see what's happening. Mm. It's done really well in America, and I think I think everyone sort of wants another series, so we're just waiting to find out.
Just to go back to Pulp.
Yeah.
That kid. You remember when you were a teenager and you thought of, like, you know, Zeppelin or the Beatles or whatever as some part of long past history? That's how he feels about Pulp.
Yeah, it's the same.
Isn't that weird?
It's almost the same distance between me finding my parents' Beatles albums and him finding Pulp. It's
the same. It's like 20 years or 25 years or something.
But do you know what? When I was at school, I bought Misshapes. I think it was a single, talking about singles. I think I bought a CD single of Misshapes.
Yeah.
And my friends just absolutely rinsed me. They just took the piss out of me for buying that. And they, at the same time, had bought the Out Here Brothers' Boom Boom Boom. And that was the cool stuff to buy at the time.
But you must have been a very young teen then. Because if you're like older than 15, you'd know that Boom 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 is not cooler, surely. I mean, you must have been like 12 or 13, right?
Maybe I was 12 or 13. But
yeah. You couldn't have been like 19 and them going, what?
I think that what you're saying is I was the mature one. I could see the longevity.
Absolutely. You were ahead of
Jarvis
your time.
Jarvis Cocker's career.
But there would have been morons if
but
they were.
Maybe it's great. It's better to burn bright and fade.
Yeah.
It's burn bright and extinguish like the Out Here Brothers than it is to... It's just.
I thought you were going to say like Kurt Cobain or someone, but yeah.
No,
yeah,
the Out Here Brothers. Yeah. Out Here Brothers, Kurt Cobain, whoever your hero is.
They were my musical icons. So please don't like try and take your life tomorrow or the next day, just because if you've said that on air and I didn't pick up on your signals,
I don't think the Out Here Brothers.
No, but you said it's better to burn bright and fade away.
Yeah, but
I
really meant was just have that one hit and then get shit straight away.
I just didn't want this to be a cry for help via my show.
No, that's the tour.
Over 28 dates.
28 date cry for help.
And let's just plug it for you because it would be crazy not to, because, you know, people can't Google things like this. It starts on the 27th of September. That's pretty fucking soon.
That's Wednesday, mate. That's next Wednesday.
Okay,
well, good luck. It goes on to the 18th of November.
Good luck with the tour. Before you say goodbye to us...
I mean, you said that with a lot of doubt in you. Good luck with the tour. I mean...
I feel
you're genuinely giving me good luck.
Good luck with the tour.
Good luck with the tour.
Good luck with the tour.
Like it's a done deal. Like it's already done well.
You don't need luck. Have fun on the tour.
Don't need that.
Enjoy
mate.
The tour. It'll be amazing. You know what? You've not done a tour before. There's so much more fun than doing Edinburgh because they're not sitting there going, I could have seen 2,000 other shows right now. You better be fucking good.
They're there
good.
For you.
They're there for you.
Yes.
Good luck with the tour.
That was worse.
Oh, God.
Somehow worse.
So before you go, you've picked a guilty pleasure for us. You, I presume you're a fan of, it sounds like you like a lot of sort of cult movies, B movies, that kind of thing. Mm. But this is a straight, you've picked something that's so straight down the middle that it's kind of surprising from you.
It's like my Out Here Brothers. It's like
sort of is. This is your out here or out there brothers?
I think they're out here brothers. Or were they the Out There Brothers? That doesn't sound right out there. But maybe I've been saying it wrong all this time. I don't mind mainstream stuff, but I find all of the things that I love have been because I found them by myself. You know, like my favourite film is Army of Darkness and Evil Dead 3. And I've got that from a video shop and I watched that and I fell in love with that. And no one had ever seen it. No one would ever watch it, and that was a very solitary kind of passion for me for years and years until Evil Dead became big again. And then my favourite band is Alice Cooper, and I found that by myself, and nobody likes Alice Cooper, nobody, and even today I have to convince people to come and see Alice Cooper with me, and that's a very and
he's
so
not
those
he's not had a sort of like resurgence really, or like a,
he's just had a new album out.
No, I mean like it's not like been sort of claimed by hipsters or something
and
like
I'm,
that
and
do you know
I'm,
what I mean
I'm sort of glad.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very glad.
Because he's still
my
yours.
Thing. He's still mine, and he's still. He did a podcast with Mark Moran.
Yeah. Or it might be Moran.
I don't listen to podcasts, right? But like eight people all got in contact and said, "Oh, Alice Cooper's done Mark Maron's podcast," and that was really nice because people knew that I would have liked that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then all of a sudden you go, oh, right. So I just think that's
I was surprised to learn that he was quite a staunch Republican. That was one thing.
Who,
that,
Alice?
Yeah.
You just try not to... I've met him a few times. I've met him three times. And I just always just think, you know, just... It's famous, isn't it? Don't meet your heroes. Generally, that's because you're the dick. Okay. You meet your hero and you...
Project.
Are such a bellend... that it's tainted their body of work forever. But with Alice Cooper...
I find that not just with meeting my heroes, but people in general. I taint, you know...
Yeah, right. Better to leave it as a distant imagination of what it could be. But apparently Alice Cooper's really nice. It's just that I've always seen him when he's very tired.
Oh, tired Alice.
Tired Alice.
So tell us what your guilty pleasure is.
My guilty pleasure is
it's two. Yeah.
But and I don't go across the board for all of them, but I'm a bit of an apologist when it comes to this guy. And my two guilty pleasures are That's My Boy, starring Adam Sandler, and Mr. Deeds, starring Adam Sandler.
There's a theme.
And I think that Adam Sandler made two really good films near the beginning of his career. And people loved them. Happy Gilmore and Wedding Singer. Mm-hmm. I think that he made like the really funny film, and then he made a romantic film, and that kind of got everyone on board. And the people that are still diehard Adam Sandler films are still basically deep down hoping that one day he'll come back and he'll do something that's as good as that again.
So, but he's made about 20 films since then, hasn't
and
he?
And the love for those two films, yeah, kind of makes people a bit blinded by it all.
What do you think of his when he goes off brand with his the Cobbler and the Rain Over Me and Punch Drunk Love?
Well,
and
people say that he stopped trying.
Yeah.
People say that he stopped trying, that he's lazy, but I mean every couple of years he does something.
That doesn't imply laziness.
He does do something that's also different from his brand, but a lot of the time it doesn't work. But a lot of the time that doesn't work for people that make that their brand.
Yeah.
You know, Punch Drunk Love is obviously amazing, but that was is that P.T. Anderson. So I mean, he Punch Drunk Love is P.T. Anderson completely understanding his subject, Adam Sandler, and making this amazing film around him.
I quite like Rain Over Me. Did you see that one?
I didn't see Rain Over Me, but I didn't really enjoy Spanglish that much, and I thought The Cobbler was absolutely fucking atrocious. But he's working with the right people.
Yeah. You kind of go, oh, that guy who made Station Agent and Win-Win, This should be a happy marriage. And I haven't seen The Cobbler, I have to say. I quite like the look of it, but I heard some pretty nasty reviews about it.
The idea's all right. It's just the tone of it's wrong. And it's just kind of, and it's a bit, it's just depressing and weird. And I just didn't think it worked.
But, so what is it about that smart? But by the way, a comedian you and I both know who comes and does a lot of new sort of like talking about latest films and stuff on the show is James Gill, and he is a massive Adam Sandler fan, and he's always championing him because he believes that he's sort of a bit misunderstood.
I think he's misunderstood. And, well, me and James are mates, and we talk about it quite a lot.
Yeah, and he's, I think people are just snobbish, aren't they? Because, what do you write about?
He makes bad films. He does make bad films. I mean, Jack and Jill is terrible. And
what do you like about That's My Boy and Mr. Deeds?
It's just so relentless. So much. They went for a hard R.
Yeah.
And they've made a film that's got just so much swearing in it and so much sex in it and so much kind of just grim, unpleasant humour in it. And they really went for it. And it's quite a sweet film, but it's just got Adam Sandler with a massive prosthetic penis masturbating and over someone's gran, and it's
Jesus.
And the whole basically setup for the film is kind of inappropriate. It's based on a real story about a kid that had sex with his teacher and she became pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, it's based on abuse kids, basically.
Yeah, that's...
And they made this kind of broad knockabout comedy out of it. And if you just take all of that aspect out of it...
You mean the basis of the movie?
The kid was championed as kind of an absolute legend for having sex with his teacher.
Well, I guess...
And that's what the film is.
Yeah.
And, now I've said that out loud, maybe it should be my guilty pleasure. But
Well, it definitely adds weight to the guilt part of it.
Definitely adds weight to the guilt. Maybe I'll just focus on Mr. Deeds.
Which is a film about a man that killed a baby.
Mr. Deeds.
It's a knockabout comedy.
Mr. Deeds is based on the Frank Capra movie Mr. Deeds Goes to Washington, which is
it's one of the classics, right?
Great film. But they've just, and everyone's going it's kind of it's very disrespectful to the original source material. And you go, well, of course it is. It's Adam Sandler. I mean, he's not, I think that in his heart he wants to be making Frank Capra movies that make everyone kind of now they're a little bit more cynical, think, where he's kind of aiming for heartstrings, whereas that almost came quite naturally in his earlier films.
Yeah, there's something about The Wedding Singer where it just all worked for some reason.
I think a lot of that is him and Drew Barrymore, and they were great together. To the point that I even gave Blended a pass, which was them in South Africa blending their families together. I watched that on a plane. and I cried. But I think that was the altitude.
What is it about planes that make movies so much better than they really are? I've seen some stinkers that I've loved on planes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Things that I've just, as I'm in it, watching it, going, I know that I shouldn't like this, but this is amazing.
Yeah.
There has got to be a theory.
I just think it's the fact that you're either going somewhere or you're coming away from somewhere that you loved, and this is your comfort thing, isn't it? It's taking you...
I also get very constipated when I'm high up, but I don't know if that's got any connection to that.
I don't think it has. I think you just put that in there. Mr. Deeds is really great, I think, because they've taken like the basis, and it's not just his character. There's actually a lot of really funny characters that surround him in, I think. And also,
I've not seen Mr. Deeds. What? Who are the like supporting cast in that one?
So you've got John Turturro as a butler, and Winona Ryder is a reporter. She's got a boss that's played by Richard Harris's son,
Jared Harris.
Jared Harris. And they're all doing really broad, and the comedy is really it's the thing that Adam Sandler doesn't do anymore, which is it's really surreal and really kind of like there'll be something that comes completely out of left field. There's a bit when there's a building on fire and someone's got to save the cats, and so he's throwing all these cats out the window. And everyone's like catching them in weird places, and one of them goes down a sewer, and somebody sticks their head out the sewer, and the cat's on their head, and then there's like this cake, and they catch a cat and a cake.
Oh
and
my God!
It's really surreal,
it's
and
like
then all
French
of a sudden
farce or
they
something.
Stop doing it,
right?
And then the tone changes, and then there's a bit when they're all on a plane, and they all sort of start singing David Bowie, and then that and it's just all these.
You're actually selling this really well to me.
I think that they got to a point where it's kind of like Adam Sandler was never rewarded for the good films that he made because everyone said they're all awful, and so he stopped caring what anyone thought about him, and he just sort of like made films, and that meant that I think there's something that's affected his quality control, because when he did make good films, which I think Mr. Deeds is a good film, I think it's definitely as good as The Wedding Singer. It's a different film from The Wedding Singer, but it's as enjoyable as that. And because nobody... that was on telly, and that got one star in the Radio Times. And you go, right, well, that was hated. But then if that's one star, then what's Jack and Jill?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not one star, is it? At worst, it's three stars.
Yeah.
If not, but...
Very few films are actually one star when you actually think about, you know, telling a story and putting it together. Are there?
Yeah, but even if something's... Like, Jack and Jill could have the best cinematography ever, and as a cinematography enthusiast, you could sit down and enjoy that on a whole new level.
Yeah, it could be.
But you're never going to give that more than one star, because the majority of people aren't watching films just for an aesthetic.
I do feel like his films could be a bit more epic in its cinematography. Bit more.
Well, that's the thing. Also, he works with the same like three directors. Is it David Dobkin and?
He does loads of those sort of Eddie Murphy type movies, doesn't he?
He did Shanghai Noon or Shanghai Nights, and there's another guy that he works with all the time.
Who?
Dennis Dugan.
What a name. I like that.
He works with him loads, and there's always shots of them on set, and he's the director, but he's also manning a barbecue. Mm. And they're just having so much fun on set, and you just think, yeah, but, you know, you don't see loads of shots of Steven Spielberg manning a barbecue. No. You see him behind a...
I love that.
So
maybe people are like, look, he's not going to make a good film, but the food on set is amazing.
I think that's how he gets all the cast members. Yeah. You know, and the people.
You've tasted
really
David Dennis's sausages,
Dennis's
right?
Sausages.
Oh man, you've got to hire this guy.
It's like a summer camp. They always just have like these amazing experiences.
Well, I'd heard from a very from like a fairly reliable source, but someone who's connected to, you know, like I don't know, two people along to him, who said that he just doesn't care about critics. Like he makes films. goes and does test screenings in Middle America and only gives a shit about what real audiences, not in New York or LA or any of that. Just he just wants to do crowd pleasers.
And he's meant to be one of the nicest people on the planet.
And he's meant to be really sweet
guy. Judd Apatow just can't stop saying nice things about him, basically. And I like to believe that side of him, because I don't think that, because we were talking off air about the Ridiculous Six, and it's like a 2.5 hour western that he's made, where
it's his Dances with Wolves.
People call him lazy, and it's not a good film, but the amount of effort it would have taken to do a period western.
Yeah.
You know,
which he's written or co-written as well.
Which he's co-written. Yeah. It's an epic. He's
and
produced
the stunts.
It. The stunts. And it's kind of like he's done all the right things. The cast is pretty amazing. It's got like half of Reservoir Dogs in it.
Yeah. And half of SNL from the early 90s.
Any film with David Spade in it is a good one. It's not necessarily good.
I'm definitely going to watch Mr. Deeds based on your like trippy description of it.
I think out of all of his body of work, it's in the top half.
Really?
Top quarter.
Okay,
good. I think it's really good. And That's My Boy is just so absolutely, it's designed to offend you on every level. And he puts on this really thick Boston accent all the way through it. And it's just ridiculous. I just think, me and Brett Goldstein are big fans of that.
Yeah.
And I think every so often we'll have like a quiet moment in a kitchen.
Your text, like, do you want to meet up and talk about That's My Boy?
That's My Boy. It's kind of
a little club. I love it. So we're going to play out your second song that you've picked. This is from the man that you clearly adore, that we've spoken about, Alice Cooper. What is this song and which film is it from?
This song is called He's Back. The Man Behind the Mask.
Yeah.
He's back. He's the Man Behind the Mask. And it is from Friday the 13th, Part 6. What's the subtitle?
Jason Lives.
Jason Lives.
Yeah. Is this, as an Alice Cooper fan, is this in his, like, is this one of his greats? Or
I think it's a really fun song. And it was the beginning of his comeback in the 80s. So, like, I think 1983, he basically quit. He was, like, had substance abuse and he was an alcoholic. And he almost died and he just quit the industry. And then about 1986, he started his comeback. And he had an album called Constrictor that came out, and this single, and they did a video for it, which had Jason in it, and it was a bunch of kids in a drive-in, I think, and they were watching Alice Cooper come on the screen, and it was kind of like the beginning of his comeback, and I think it's really nice. And that I've got the Life and Crimes of Alice Cooper box set, and there's a demo version of it, and I actually prefer the demo a little bit more than the final release.
You should have got the demo.
But I just think it's a really fun song, and it sort of marks the beginning of him getting better.
Oh, good. Well, this is Alice Cooper. He's back, the man behind the mask. Nick, seriously, have fun on the tour. I'm not going to say the words. Good luck.
No,
but not in context. I'm sure it's going to be amazing, and I'm going to continue watching The Food Show, which I'm enjoying very much.
Thank you very much
for coming on.
Thank you.
Come on, Dad. I'm trying to make a good impression.
It's a lovely night. Walking in the moonlight is very romantic. Trust me.
But, Dad, you promised to let me use the car if I got good grades. Dad, I want to take her to the movies. It'll take an hour to walk there.
Then you better get going. And by the way, enjoy the show. Did you enjoy the movie? Jason, I'm talking to you.
Not sure I really understood it all.
Then let me explain.
Some folks have a strange idea of entertainment.